On This Week in Enterprise Tech, we have Mr. Curtis Franklin, Mr. Brian Chee here today, and we talk about the evolution of GPS and just how vulnerable it actually is. Plus, do we depend on it too much? We'll talk about it. Plus, we have a great guest, Zoe Clellan. She is the VP of Product and Experience at Nintex, and she's going to take us through the trending market of robot process automation and just how your organization can take advantage of data integration. You shouldn't miss it. It's Wyatt on the set. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you from LastPass Studios. Securing every access point in your company doesn't have to be a challenge. LastPass unifies access and authentication to making securing employees simple and secure, even when they're working remotely. Check out LastPass.com/twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 420, recorded November 20th, 2020, Robotic Process Automation. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by LastPass. Give your IT and security leaders control of password security with the award-winning LastPass. Visit LastPass.com/twit to find out how they can help you. And by ExpressVPN. Stop letting people keep logs of what you do online and protect your online privacy with one click. For 3 extra months free with a 1-year package, go to expressvpn.com/enterprise. And by Barracuda. Did you know that 91% of all cyber attacks start with an email? To uncover the threats hiding in your Office 365 account, get a secure and free email threat scan at barracuda.com/enterprise. Welcome to Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I'm your host, Louis Maresca, your guide through this big, giant world of the enterprise. But I can't guide you by myself. I need to bring in the professionals, the experts in their field, starting with our very own Mr. Brian Chee. He's the net architect over at Sky Fiber. And I don't think he's going to be the geek in paradise for very much longer. How's the packing coming, Gbert?
All the household goods are disappearing around me. We just did the first shipment just to illustrate just how much stuff we've managed to collect over the years. It was 18,700 pounds. Wow. So that's sitting in a warehouse in Honolulu right now, and they're going to be heading off to Orlando, I believe, in the next shipment or so. Looking forward to the great adventure of literally moving from one side of the United States to the other. And I'm going to be joining Curt Franklin in Orlando, and we're going to see how much trouble we can get into together.
I'm looking forward to hearing about that. Well, speaking of Mr. Curtis Franklin, he's the senior editor at Dark Reading and also one of the co-hosts today, and a very busy guy. Curtis, how are you doing, my friend? What's keeping you busy?
Well, right now, the things that are keeping me busy are on my honey-do list. I'm taking a few days off from Dark Reading and getting some stuff done around the house, which is wonderful now that we're enjoying a little bit, just a taste, not too much, but a little bit of fall down here in the Sunshine State. So having a good time, doing lots of stuff. I could tell you all about the process of caulking today, but I won't, because we have much better things to talk about here on Twyatt.
Well, folks, next week might be time off for us. And you know what? I had some time off this week, but definitely not time off for enterprise news. We have quite a busy week in enterprise news, so let's go ahead and jump into all of it. Now, we're going to take you through the amazing evolution of GPS technology, but we're also going to talk about just how vulnerable it may be, and we might have too much dependency on it. We'll get into that discussion. Plus, we have a great guest today, Zoe Clellan. She is the VP of Product and Experience at Nintex, and she's going to take us through the trending market of robot process automation and just how you can have your organization take advantage of it and all the integration capabilities. But before we get to all that, we should jump into this week's blips. Now, Python has been a language that has impacted the world for over 30 years. Now, its creator, Guido van Rossum, he's a decorated developer and has been active in the Python's community since its inception. Now, the Dutch programmer started working on it way back in 1989. Now, he continued to actively work on the language during his time at the U.S. National Institute of Standards and Technology in the mid-90s and at various other companies afterwards, including the director of Python Labs and BOpen and Zope and Elementary security. Now, before going to Dropbox, he worked for Google from 2005 to 2012. Now, Van Rossum, who was last employed by Dropbox, retired last October after 6.5 years of the company. Now, it's pretty clear that his retirement was meant to not last that long, because this past week, Guido announced he's unretiring to join Microsoft's developer division. Now, according to Van Rossum, he will work to, quote, make using Python better for sure, not just Windows users. Now, seeing that Python is one of the most popular languages amongst AI researchers, this could foreshadow just some of the work he could focus on while being there. Now, according to Van Rossum, there are, quote, too many options to say regarding Microsoft's potential here. Now, I wish him luck. And as he continues to work out and his journey through things, I'm looking forward to what he actually does there.
Well, we've got some proposed new security features for DNS. VeriSign has proposed two new technologies for DNS name servers. One of them is the so-called authenticated resolution. It would require that the client machine authenticate to the DNS name server. It would return a network address response only if the client is authorized to access the resources it's requesting via the domain request. Authorized resolution also could help thwart DDoS attacks, because attackers wouldn't be able to access the actual addresses of their targets since they're not authorized to do so. VeriSign also has devised a technology it calls adaptive resolution, which accelerates authorized access to web pages. It speeds up the process because the name server gets the information up front about the authenticated client, you know, things like its device and browser. That ensures the information is accessed and displayed quickly and in an optimal format for the device. According to VeriSign, DNS encryption is the foundation of all this, since it allows clients to interact directly with enterprise or application-specific DNS resolvers. Therefore, the security can be more granular at this lower level of the DNS process, depending on the client, application, and enterprise. VeriSign says it's now publicly sharing authenticated and adaptive resolution technologies to get input from the community on the next steps for beefing up DNS security.
We've heard the stories about how people have been breaking in and interrupting Zoom calls and so forth. It's definitely been on the rise ever since the start of this pandemic. Well, Zoom has just released two new security features to help meeting hosts and co-hosts remove and report disruptive participants. It has also developed the at-risk meeting notifier, which scans social media sites and public resources for Zoom meeting links and notifies the account owners. The, quote, suspend participant activities feature, located under the security icon, will let hosts and co-hosts temporarily pause a Zoom call and remove a disruptive attendee. During this pause, all audio, video, in-meeting chat, annotation, screen sharing, and recording will stop, according to Zoom. As part of the process, hosts will have an option to report the user from their meeting, share details, and include a screenshot if they wish. When a report is submitted, the reported user is removed and Zoom's trust and security team is alerted. The paused meeting may then resume. This feature is enabled by default for all free and paid Zoom accounts. Dude, what I really want is I want a splash screen saying, "That's a bozo no-no."
Now, this year has been nothing short of challenging. We all know that, especially in the security space. Now, new reports are being published each and every week around this space. In fact, NewSpire recently announced the release of its Q3 2020 quarterly threat landscape report. Now, the report outlines new cyber criminal activities and tactics, techniques, and procedures, with additional insight from its threat intelligence partner, Recorded Future. Now, the Q3 2020 threat landscape report demonstrates threat actors becoming even more ruthless. Now, throughout Q3, hackers shifted focus from home networks to overburdened public entities, including the education sector and the Election Assistance Commission, or EAC. Now, malware campaigns like Emotet utilized these events as phishing lure themes to assist in the delivery. Now, they continue to see attackers using newsjacking and typo squatting techniques to attack organizations with ransomware. Now, the methods were especially prevalent this quarter with the presidential election and schools moving to a virtual learning model. Now, NewSpire observed a significant increase in malware activity over the course of Q3 2020. The fact The 128% increase from Q2 represents more than 43,000 malware variants detected each and every day. Now, as Imatet made a significant appearance, NewSpire and Recorded Future discovered new features in Imatet modules, including implying the group will likely continue operations throughout the remainder of the next quarter to gauge the viability of these new features, successful or not. Now, additional notable findings from NewSpire is that the zero-access botnet made another big appearance in Q3. It resurged in Q2. And also, we also saw office document phishing skyrocket during the second half of Q3, which could be due to the upcoming election or the actual election, or because attackers have been finished their retooling. Now, ransomware attack on the automotive industry is on the rise. At the end of Q3, references have already surpassed the 2019 total of 18,307, which is a 79.15% increase in Q4, so which is still remaining here. We've seen a lot of bots like the H Worm bot, as well as Houdini, and a bunch of other ones here that we've seen in the increase. Now, we've also seen a lot of Trojans using COVID-19 phishing lures and executable names as well. Now, all of these provide really great insights into what organizations, this report actually does as well, provide insights into what organizations should be paying attention to as their attack surface continues to grow. Now, your first step here is just ensuring that you understand the potential for the attacks before you can start providing solutions for them.
Well, a series of Cisco WebEx vulnerabilities let ghost attendees spy on your meetings. This week, Cisco WebEx patched three vulnerabilities in its video conferencing platform that could allow an attacker to join meetings as a ghost without appearing on the participant list, stay in a meeting after being expelled, and gain access to attendees' data in the meeting room lobby. The vulnerabilities were discovered by IBM Research, where experts decided to analyze the software they were depending on most as employees transitioned to home offices. The vulnerabilities they discovered exist in the handshaking process that WebEx uses to create connections between meeting attendees. An attacker with a meeting URL could manipulate the messages between the WebEx client application and WebEx server backend to join and stay in a meeting without being seen by other attendees. Patches available today should be applied, but the researchers shared some of the workarounds they adopted while fixes were in the works. IBM teams began to lock meetings at 0 minutes, researchers say, after which attendees must be manually admitted by the host. They advise watching for external attendees who may seem suspicious or for random phone numbers. Researchers also suggest locking meetings with a passcode, which attackers would then also need to exploit to get into the vulnerabilities. IBM teams also began scheduling meetings with unique IDs instead of personal meeting rooms, which are easily repeatable, but also easily guessed.
Well, Google will soon let you opt out of Gmail's data-hungry smart features entirely. So Google is adding a new option to let users opt out of having their Gmail, chat, and Meet data used to offer smart features like Smart Compose and Smart Reply, the company announced the other day. Although you've previously been able to toggle these individual features on and off, the new toggle disables the background data processing that makes them possible. Google says the new option will roll out in the coming weeks. According to images posted on Google's blog, Gmail users will be shown two dialog boxes shown for data processing. The first concerns smart features offered within Gmail, including automatic email filtering and categorizations, smart compose summary cards shown above emails, and extracting event details to create calendar entries. Google says that users won't be able to access these features if they opt out of the data processing that makes them possible. I, for one, like moving to lightweight interfaces when I'm out of the country and paying all too many roaming charges already. Maybe this is a step in the right direction.
Now, Wi-Fi has been limited in spectrum availability, which has had a cascading effect on its performance and scale. Now, there's good news coming for Wi-Fi. There's going to be a little bit more room for it. Now, the Federal Communication Commission voted this past week to open up a small amount of additional wireless spectrum for unlicensed indoor use, improving speeds and reducing congestion on the 5G or 5 gigahertz Wi-Fi networks. Now, the new portion of the spectrum, which falls around 5.9 gigahertz, was previously reserved for vehicle-to-vehicle and vehicle-to-infrastructure communication. But since being set aside two decades ago, the auto industry hasn't done much with it. So now the FCC is taking away a little bit more than half of the airways it reserved and offering them out to the public for use as Wi-Fi. Now, despite getting nowhere with the spectrum, the auto industry is nonetheless annoyed that the FCC is taking it away. So we have one happy part of the industry and one very angry part of the industry. The expansion is good news for anyone who uses Wi-Fi, since it should offer small increases to speeds and reliability once gadgets start to support it. Now, Wi-Fi has been operating around the 400 megahertz of unlicensed spectrum for the past two decades. Now, the vote opens up another 45 megahertz, which represents a small but meaningful improvement for Wi-Fi in here. That said, even a bigger prize for Wi-Fi was opened up earlier this year. Now, in April, the commission voted to open 1,200 megahertz of spectrum in the 6 gigahertz band, quadrupling the total available space. Now, gadgets by and large have been updated to support this new spectrum yet, but it should lead to considerable improvements in speed and reliability once they are. Now, with the advent of the new Wi-Fi standards and hardware, this will help the technology scale, especially in the near future. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, we have the bites. But before we get to the bites, we have to thank a really great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's LastPass. Now, we know you can't trust your most valuable data with just any company, and that's why LastPass has been our choice for identity and access management. But we aren't the only ones to say that. Now, LastPass has been named a leader in the G2 Fall Grid Reports and a leading peer-to-peer review site that provides unbiased user reviews on leading software solutions. Now, of the 746 customers that have left user reviews, 93% of LastPass users rated them 4 or 5 stars. Now, I definitely give them 5 stars because I use them every day. Now, you're probably wondering, what is it that makes LastPass so unique and viable and vital for your business? Well, I could probably go on for a long time, but it offers the ability to, for your IT and security leaders to take back control of password security. They have all the power that they need for central dashboard. They have businesses can customize admin privileges, ensuring that any given admin has only the right level access. Plus, you'll gain company-wide visibility that shows your actual progress. And no matter your organization's source of truth, LastPass integrates to onboard users, sync groups, and revoke access if you need to. Plus, LastPass allows actionable insights for your admins. In fact, they have access security scores. You can see real-time readouts of your business's password hygiene and track improvements over time. And in fact, they have review. You can actually review audit reports too. They help build compliance and maintain accountability with detailed reporting logs that tie actions to specific individuals, which is very helpful. Now, for every employee, you can view their password scores, gain access to shared accounts, monitor group membership, and much, much more. Now, your company can also enable and require MFA, which is really important in this landscape, and making logging into different sites simple and easy while still be very secure. Now, the built-in password generator also creates long, randomized passwords that protect against hijacking and hacking. Now, employees can easily and securely share passwords, notes, and other sensitive information through LastPass. I use it for the notes feature because it encrypts everything, which is great. Now, leverage over 100 policies and advanced security features, or use their out-of-the-box configurations for balance between security and convenience. Now, LastPass has won 8 awards so far this year. They are PC Mag's Editor's Choice. They won the Fortress Cybersecurity Award, and they are Business Insider's Best Overall Password Manager, just to name a few. Probably going to name a lot more there. Let the award-winning LastPass help you take back control of your password security. Go to LastPass.com/twit. That's LastPass.com/twit. And we thank LastPass for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's now time for the bites. Now, our first bite is the amazing backstory of the evolution of GPS. Now, Greg Milner does a great job in his New Yorker article here about the journey of GPS and its proliferation. But I also want to talk a little about the GPS technology and maybe even some of the dependencies we have here. Because I'll tell you one thing, GPS is ingrained within our daily lives, both personally and professionally. And when technology reaches a point like that, it becomes a target as well. Now, let's take the story back here to midnight June 20th of 2012. Now, that's when Todd Humphries made the final preparations for his attack on the GPS system. Now, on a hill just a kilometer away, his team actually gathered around a flat metal box the size of a carry-on suitcase. Now, the electronic machinery inside the box was called a spoofer. That was actually the weapon name. Now, soon a Hornet Mini, a drone-operated helicopter popular with law enforcement and rescue agencies, was scheduled to appear 40 feet above them, then the spoofer would be put to test. Now, that's when they start talking about just how risky it is to use sometimes GPS, depending on the type of attack you have. Now, think about GPS. GPS is available for free to anyone in the world. There are 24 active GPS satellites orbiting in 20,000 kilometers, each emitting a radio signal containing a time code and a description of the satellite's exact position. Now, by measuring the transmission of time of the signal, a GPS receiver determines its distance from the satellite. Now, if the receiver does this simultaneously with the signals of at least four satellites in its line of sight, it can actually extrapolate its position in three dimensions. Now, during roughly 67 milliseconds the signal takes to reach us, it grows exceedingly faint. So there's actually a problem there. The task of receiving the signal and extracting its information component is often compared to trying to read it using a light bulb in a different city far away, right? Now, this system's core technology has remained the same since the first GPS satellite was launched in 1977, but its uses actually have proliferated at a really astonishing speed. Now, the reason the number of GPS receivers could double tomorrow without affecting the underlying infrastructure at all is just because of the timing part of it. Now, the GPS has been out for many years, and it's had some controversies as well. Now, this article goes into the history and the debate behind it, but I do want to go into the crucial components of GPS and just how a change in a disruption of service can actually have a domino effect on the world. Now, GPS is crucial to many different systems that are actually unrelated to geolocation systems. Now, because GPS clocks are actually synchronized to within nanoseconds, the network signals are used to actually unify time-dependent systems spread over large areas. Now, GPS time actually helps bounce calls between cellular towers, regulate power flows and electrical grids, and timestamp financial trades on major exchanges. Now, if a spoofer were to actually feed bad data or information that confused the clocks in even a few nodes of these systems, the damage could actually be widespread. Actually, you have, as time errors multiply, communication systems would fail. Wrongly apportioned power flows could result in blackouts, and automated training programs could yank themselves out of the market, causing crashes. Now, those are just a few scenarios, to name a few. Now, we still have not figured out exactly how to safeguard technology that's so crucial yet so porous. But what this points out is we see consensus that GPS is wonderful, but we need to start cutting the habit on it, the dependency on it. Now, that's the first thing I want to talk about with everyone here, because it really is a problem that we depend on this a lot. Curtis, I want to throw this to you first. GPS is something both that we both use personally and professionally, and we count it. We depend on it, but there's a failure point, right? There's a potential there to fail. Is this misguided trust in the technology?
Well, it's certainly a single point of failure for many different things. Interestingly enough, navigation, especially commercial navigation, may or may not see it as a single point of failure. There are, in fact, backup systems that are available going all the way back to using a compass and a sextant to find your locations. But for a lot of others, there is no way around it. It's used in too many, you mentioned time, applications. There are an awful lot of encryption algorithms that are based on that mutually agreed upon time. There are all kinds of different location applications where they don't have the backups in place. And those go down to things like farmers making sure their crops are planted in nice straight rows, or crews grading surfaces where roads are going to be. So we have become amazingly dependent on the GPS technology just in a couple of decades. And it's going to be a rude surprise for lots and lots of industries if that ever goes away.
Right, right. Yeah, I think the interesting thing about this is, like you said, it does depend on, you know, some of these technologies depend on the synchronized clocks. And I mentioned it a little bit. Cheapert, I want to throw this to you because obviously you've worked in networks for a very long time. And GPS is also a clock for most cell towers to actually coordinate calls and coordination. Is this something that they should be depending on here, especially with how viable and how open they are to attacks?
Well, I think the reason why a lot of things are synchronized from the GPS clocks is because it's free. It's cheap. It's easy. I literally built a Stratum 1 NTP server. So I take the clock sync directly off the GPS constellation. And I built that for $65, you know, really cheap. I don't have to buy something like a Symmetricon for like $4,000. And the cool thing is I can even build my own GPS antennas now. So when you start getting this kind of technology that accurate for that little money, you start getting some real widespread adoption. Now, our bacon isn't quite in the frying pan yet. Texas Instruments is supposed to be coming out. They've got it in beta and so forth. A new type of chip. It's a new clock chip. So NTP, Network Time Protocol, got started because the clocks in PCs have been notoriously horrible. I don't know if you remember the old days, your PC clock could potentially drift as much as an hour away from actual clock over a period of a year. So, bummer. Anyway, the TI chip is supposed to have a actual small chunk of cesium in it. So it's like an atomic clock, but it's a chip, and it's supposed to be in a package cheap enough that you can integrate it in to replace the clock chips on modern PCs. Sadly, it hasn't shown up yet. So that is a potential fix. But the GPS is nice. So like when I did a test, I wanted to go and find out what the real latency was over a point-to-point microwave link. I actually had GPS synchronized test gear from AdTech in Honolulu, and it was accurate enough that I could actually measure the accuracy, how fast was the microwave link. Can't do that with any other technology, so that's going to be interesting. And even my underwater observatories, even though they can't see GPS satellites, they use GPS fed from land over the network using a new version of a network time protocol called IEEE 1588 Precision Time Protocol, where instead of having only a one pulse per second clock, I can now get accuracy down into the microsecond range. And another variation is being done. I can't remember the name anymore, but the folks at CERN Laboratories are using it to use with their colliders, and those are down to nanosecond resolution over the network. So yeah, that cascade effect could get really, really big because there's an awful lot of things, cell phones, authentication, Active Directory, and things like that. If the clocks are too far off, things start breaking. I have actually had an Active Directory that wouldn't let me log in because the clocks on the servers were too far off. Bummer.
I do want to point that out. That's a good point, because there are a lot of enterprise features that take advantage of GPS. They add new features and they say, hey, we're going to use GPS to help with not only the clock synchronization, but also location-based data and geolocatable data. Now, Curtis, I want to throw this to you. Do you think that this is something that maybe enterprises shouldn't be doing? Is that irresponsible? It's just because it's potentially GPS is free, it's easy to implement, it's easy to put in their systems and build out new features around it. But that doesn't mean it's the best thing to do, especially since now we're seeing how vulnerable it is. So what do you think? Is this irresponsible? Is it something they should be doing? Or is it, like Cheever said, add some fail-safe in there and you should be good to go?
Yeah, I'm going to agree with Brian on this one. The fact is that for many, many applications, especially when you get into the directional and guidance side of things, there aren't low-cost, easy-to-implement alternatives. You might as well go ahead, use GPS, but recognize that it can be spoofed, it can be attacked, and basically train your users to use a little bit of common sense. There was a great example of this a couple of years ago when what is now generally acknowledged to be a Russian GPS spoofing attack left a bunch of sea captains seeing their GPS show their large container ships sitting about 20 miles inland. So they knew that this wasn't the case, and they reacted accordingly. Everyone should be encouraged to do exactly the same. When it comes to timekeeping, once again, feel free to use GPS. It's accurate. It's fast. It's almost universally available. But make sure you have some sort of backup, whether that's a highly accurate on-site timekeeping device or a consistent link back to one of the universal time codes. Have a backup. It's advice that's good in so very many areas of enterprise IT.
All right, redundancy, very important. Chibert, I want to throw the last question to you, especially around redundancy when it comes to networks and even cell networks and towers. What is there redundancy around here? Like, obviously, they're using GPS for this whole synchronization model, but what is the alternative here? And Curtis alluded to a couple there, but from network timing to other server timing, so on and so forth, is there really a good alternative here that's safe and reliable for organizations to depend on?
Well, when you start talking about cell phone networks, one of the tricks that came up when we were doing some work for NATO was we literally laid fiber between dedicated cell towers. And so I actually had an atomic clock in my van, and I used that instead of GPS because, you know, we didn't want to have all our eggs in one basket. So they do exist. You can buy an atomic clock. They're not going to be as accurate as the one in Colorado, but they aren't bad. Now, keep in mind, just because your clock is a few seconds off or even a minute off doesn't mean that your authentication is going to break. I think the last time I actually tried this, the magic number, I think, was 3 minutes before Active Directory barfed all over me. It's one of those weird things. We actually discovered it. Actually, it was Wayne Rash and I that figured it out during a identity management shootout back in my lab in Honolulu. And that was kind of an eye-opener because it wasn't really discussed in polite company very often. But I think people need to understand if authentication starts failing, especially, you know, if it's odd, it worked before, check your clock, because for some reason or another, I've actually seen some, I'm not sure if I'd call it malware, maybe it's brokenware is a better description, where apps accidentally have changed the clock on my PC. You know, basically what it was is it changed the time zone. And it just kind of broke. So, yeah, someday. If anyone from TI is listening, could someone contact me at chibert@twit.tv? What happened to your atomic clock chip? I saw, I think it was in Science Magazine or something like that, about 4 years ago. And I'm wondering what happened to that product, because that would solve an amazing number of problems. Especially for cell phone operators.
Right. Thanks, Chibert. Definitely redundancy, and backup is a lesson learned here, especially when it comes to GPS. Well, folks, that does it for the Bites. Next up, we have a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. But before we get to the guest, we have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that is ExpressVPN. Now, what if I told you every time you go online, your internet provider like AT&T or Comcast is allowed to store logs of every website you've ever visited and can legally sell this data to anyone. That's why I always use ExpressVPN. Now, ExpressVPN actually reroutes your internet connection through their secure servers, so your internet provider can't see or log what you do online. Now, many of you might be wondering, well, if I'm routing all my data through a VPN, then doesn't that just mean that the VPN can see what I'm doing and log that data instead and sell that data? Well, you're right thinking there, but many VPNs claim to have no logs policy, but have been caught in logging customer activity. But ExpressVPN is the only VPN I trust because they use trusted server technology. They were the first major VPN provider to engineer all the VPN servers to run in RAM and memory. This makes it impossible for the VPN servers to store any data, persist that data, including logs of any ExpressVPN customer. Now, and you don't have to take my word for it here. ExpressVPN is so confident in their no logs claim. They've even had one of the biggest assurance firms, PwC, PricewaterhouseCoopers, audit their technology just to let everyone know what they're doing here. Now, it's no wonder that CNET and Wired named ExpressVPN the number one VPN in the world. And I definitely consider them that as well. And when you do end up, you know, going traveling again, there's actually a bunch of layers to help in the trust here. And that's where VPN comes in. I've traveled globally and I can tell you that ExpressVPN really adds a peace of mind for me because it makes me feel more comfortable that my traffic is private to me, no matter what I'm doing. You know, even if I'm using a Wi-Fi at a business that I don't usually visit, it adds just another layer of protection for me. It just makes me think about all the personal data that I send over that connection, and I just don't want the owners of that connection seeing it. So that's why I use ExpressVPN. Stop letting people keep logs of what you do online. Visit expressvpn.com/enterprise right now and find out how you can get an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN for free. That's expressvpn.com/enterprise. ExpressVPN.com/enterprise to learn more. And we thank ExpressVPN for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's my favorite part of the show where we get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twiat Riot. Today we have Zoe Clellan. She is the VP of Product and Experience at Nintex. Welcome to the show, Zoe.
Hey, me. Excited to be here.
Now, people always have interesting stories about how they've navigated through the industry. Can you take us on a short journey through tech and what brought you to Nintex?
Yes. I actually started out in human factors psychology, and that is basically half psychology. What can a human do? How does cognition work? Perception, anthropometrics, all of that, coupled with engineering. So that includes how to design systems from facilities, ergonomics, software. And so I started out in medical and quickly realized that that was fascinating, but a very slow road to innovation. And so moved over into tech in 2005 and have been there ever since.
Fantastic. Now, you're in a very, very interesting space as it is, the RPA, robotic process automation. Now, it sounds really cool, but I'm sure that people at home want to know a little bit more about the industry, maybe the background RPA and what helped lead up to the development of the technology. Can you maybe go through that?
Yeah, it's quite innovative. And at Nintex, we acquired an RPA company called EnableSoft a couple years ago. And so we are getting deeper into the power, both, you know, the pros and cons and the risks around some of that. And so that really developed out of the knowledge that human beings have a lot of entry tasks that they do, and down to the level of keystrokes and input fields and basically being able to understand what is on a screen, whatever that screen may be, and replicating what a human will do to add information, make changes, transfer content, any of those sorts of things. And so I think when folks think about, you know, RPA and robotic process, they kind of think of a big robot, and it's not that at all, right? It's basically an intelligent program that runs on your computer that automates those manual, repetitive, really time-consuming and costly tasks that you do every day.
Now, when it comes to, like, what's the robotic part of it? Is it that it uses, you know, AI or something like that to learn how to do those processes? Do you have to program them to do it? How's it usually set up and implemented?
Yeah, primarily, certainly IA can be layered in there, but the idea is that you set up what the human does. So you're going to look at a screen, let's say on the internet, and you're going to say, this field right here needs to pull information from maybe this Excel sheet or this place. And so there is some programming and some upfront work to do that, to get it really set up that matches exactly what the human does. And that's the difference, right? When we talk about process automation, that is truly the orchestrator that's pulling data across systems. It's including humans when that's relevant for approvals or reviews. But RPA in particular is very much about knowing what I maybe as a single user do that is, frankly, just not a use of a good use of my big brain, for example, and it automates all of that. So as part of bigger process automation, you have something that really can come and log in as you, but, you know, in a fraction of the time that it would take you to fill something out, to transfer that data, to do all that duplication. And so really the robotic part of it is that you are both programming the system to do what you would do in a given situation and laying over intelligence. So in many cases, it can learn what you're doing. It can change and grow, but there is some fragility to the fact that it's mapping to exactly what I might do as a human. And so if it encounters something unexpected, it kind of changes the response that it can have and can be a little bit surprising.
So that's interesting. I didn't know they actually overlaid some intelligence and some insightful stuff there. One thing that made me kind of spark up a little bit, obviously I'm a developer, I'm a programmer, but does it take a developer and programmer to implement RPA? You talked about point-to-point integration, mm-hmm. and then you program it to do the right thing. Is that mm-hmm. where people have to go and learn some new programming language, or is it something that you can assist with?
Absolutely. Today it is, very much in the realm of low code, no code. And so certainly, you know, all sorts of companies will have a different approach to doing that. But the way that Nintex RPA operates is really very visual. So you will pull up your source content, let's say if you want to move data from one place to another, and your destination. And you have basically a whole toolbox of different actions that you can take, hundreds and hundreds, sometimes thousands of different actions that come out of the box. So I might go ahead and open up, let's say, SAP, and I need to take something out of my CRM. My SAP maybe isn't HANA, so it's hooked up from a legacy perspective, and there aren't strong APIs to use that or gateways that I can leverage, let's say in my example. And so what I want to do is I pull that up and we use a bullseye technology that I can go in and say, I want you to click into this field and I want you to take this action. Maybe I go grab text from somewhere. Maybe I open a Dropbox. Maybe I select the date picker and put in the current date. And so basically you've got a whole toolkit that you can use to tell the system exactly what you need it to do on a very granular level, but it's not having to learn a new language at all, which is why it is so powerful and why it's become so popular recently.
Right. Yeah, I think that that's an interesting space because we see a lot of players in the space. They all do something different. In fact, I'm actually seeing data. Seems like a huge market. They anticipate the size to reach 8.7 billion by 2026, growing at 29.5%. And obviously one of the major goals they say here is to eliminate human errors. Obviously manual user interactions, those repetitive tasks over and over again, the point to point. One question I have for you here is this around, can this automate entire processes, entire workflows, or is it just a point to point type thing?
It is not, I think it would depend on who you were talking to. Some of the RPA vendors might say that it can. I look at RPA as very much of one tool in your toolkit, and certainly not to undervalue any of the technology as a tool or a utility, because I don't think that's true at all. But, one of the things that we say, and I'm not the first person to say it, the analysts will talk about it as well, is that when you have RPA, it becomes a hammer. And when you have a hammer, everything's a nail. And so I will often talk to customers and they'll say, oh, Zoe, I'm so excited to talk to you. We've got 100 RPA projects. That's our goal for this year. Isn't that great? And I think maybe it is, but maybe you're actually just using your hammer a little too liberally. And so the real difference there is, as you highlighted, right, huge gains in terms of freeing up the user to do much more high value tasks than manual entry, absolutely increasing the speed, reducing the errors. But it is not an orchestrator. And so I sort of like to think about, I was working on a little analogy this morning. We'll see how it lands with you, Lou. But, I would say that workflow and process automation, specifically intelligent process automation, is the orchestrator, right? And you might even say orchestration or orchestra conductor. Mm-hmm. And so when you look at it that way, right, maybe RPA is a flute and document generation is a guitar and e-sign is a snare drum, right? You know, maybe analytics is the audience watching all of this and getting insights and value from it. And when you look at wider digital transformation, right, this is all predicated on the idea that you know what process you're trying to improve and what it looks like when it's really efficient. And that, to me, the process mapping and management part of it is very much kind of the sheet of music that everyone is working off of. And so really, it is one of those things that fits in for a lot of, I mean, an amazing number of use cases, but it is not actually an end-to-end solution for process optimization.
God, I really like that analogy. Really good. Well, when we come back, I do want to bring my co-host back in because they do have a bunch of questions here. But before we do, we have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that is Barracuda. Now, Barracuda is the provider of cloud-enabled enterprise-grade security solutions that protect email, networks, data, and applications. Now, we've been talking a lot about these today, in fact. Now, suddenly you have dozens, hundreds, or maybe even thousands of employees working remotely, each and every one of them getting tons of email every day, making them vulnerable. Now, 91% of all cyber attacks start in an email. You know this. Now, spear phishing, ransomware, account takeover, conversation hijacking. You multiply that by how many employees' time, how many emails they actually get. One click on the wrong email can cost you money, customers, and your company's reputation. Now, Barracuda researchers have seen a steady increase in the number of coronavirus-related spear phishing attacks since January, and they've actually observed a recent spike of 667% in that type of attack since the end of February. That's a lot. Now get the protection you need for your company with Barracuda Total Email Protection. It includes a lot of stuff here. Listen to it. All-in-one email security backup and archiving. They have AI-based protection for spear phishing, account takeover, business email compromise. And in fact, they have automated incident response that gives you options to quickly and efficiently address attacks. Now, they also have security awareness training to educate your workforce so your employees can be the first line of defense against attacks. Now, if you take a moment and think about it, your users are your weakest link, and they're the targets. Now, I've seen organizations hit with impersonation attacks. In fact, another of them was actually targeting people's feelings and their personal feelings and fears. These attacks impersonate the World Health Organization, and the phishing emails actually appear to come from WHO with information on coronavirus, COVID-19, and people end up clicking on the links and using backdoors or malware, and they're able to take control of that user's device. Attackers utilize domain spoofing and promise information related to these types of things in an attempt to trick the users into a phishing scam. Now, ensure the safety and security of your business with Barracuda. It can really help. It can really save your organization. To uncover the threats hiding in your inbox, get a secure free email threat scan of your Office 365 account risk-free at Barracuda.com/enterprise. That's Barracuda.com/enterprise. Barracuda, your journey secured. And we thank Barracuda for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. We've been talking with Zoe Cleland. She is the VP and product and experience at Nintex. And we've been talking about RPA, robotic process automation, just the trend there and how organizations are using it and what it actually brings out. But I do want to bring my co-hosts back in because they have a bunch of questions here. I want to start with Chibert. Chibert, obviously you've actually seen organizations run through a bunch of processes. You know, what do you think? RPA can help here?
Well, what I'm curious about is the description you gave us sounds so much like some of the test tools I used to use when I was doing testing for InfoWorld, where we wanted to find out how well a web application or a portion of a web application was performing over time and under load. Are there any kind of instrumentation on your version that gives us some feedback, you know, some sort of feedback loop on how well something's performing what it's supposed to do?
Yeah. And, you know, I think there's still a lot of room for growth in that area, but the idea is, you know, now in terms of the impact on the other systems, that's sort of a different perspective. But when you know what a process looked like before, right? And so whether you look at a manual process and you evaluate it for time and cost, or you make a gut effort on the number of people that are involved and how much money that adds up to, that's the first kind of benchmark, because you want to understand where it was pre-automation and where it is now. So that's the first one. But what I've learned about, you know, any sort of process automation over the years is as you optimize it, you will understand and illuminate other weaknesses that maybe you didn't know. So to your point on performance, right? I could look at a process that we use RPA for, and I know how much time it saved us, how often it's running, how quickly it runs. And actually, Nintex has, I love it for demos, but in general, a speed control on the RPA. So you can decide whether it is lightning fast, or you slow it down a little bit. And you might be wondering, why would I ever want to slow down a process? And the truth is if the other systems that it is interacting with cannot manage that load, they will fail. And that is a thing that we can't measure. We'll obviously know when something fails, but that is sort of why it's so important to look at the wider process and the wider end-to-end orchestration of that process, is because just because you have a very powerful tool in RPA doesn't mean that all the systems that it's interacting with can stand up to the speed and the load that's possible using RPA.
Fantastic. Curtis?
Well, it seems to me that this is the sort of thing that a lot of smaller organizations might look at and say, well, that sounds great, but this has to be something that is so complex in setting up, so complex in deploying and managing, that it's only for the largest enterprises. Are they right?
I don't think that's right at all, actually. The opportunity here is, so for example, if we look at skill set, right? I'm certainly an advocate to move beyond the idea that technology is only for technologists, and in the enterprise world that only IT has the keys to those sorts of solutions. And so with Nintex RPA, one of the, if I'm looking at our screen right now and we've got the title of the podcast and we've got our names underneath, I could now go in, open up Nintex RPA, pull my little bullseye, which is a proprietary method that makes it even easier, and say, right here on this screen, I'm going to click right on the name Zoe, and I'm going to tell it to take that word, whatever it is, and on your screen, it'll be a different name, right? And pull it into an Excel. So I could set something up in a few minutes here that allowed me to grab everyone's name that's on the podcast, put it someplace else, whether it's in an Excel spreadsheet or in Salesforce, whatever CSM, whatever database that you're interested in. And it's really that easy. And I'm not going to pretend that all of it's easy. It depends on what the solution is that you're building. But the amazing thing is that in many cases, I feel that smaller businesses, and particularly individuals or smaller departments, digital transformation feels like this very big thing. And the truth is, digital transformation is as small or as big as you make it. And so RPA is actually something that if you are not able to invest in, let's say, a BPM platform, for example, or a whole field of developers or an IT team, maybe you're just not there yet. RPA is something that is affordable and very powerful on that limited scale of reproducing repetitive actions that users and employers do today in your organization. And so, and I think, you know, we'll probably get to this, but earlier this year, when the CARES Act, you know, COVID comes out and provides the opportunity for companies, particularly small businesses, to get shorter term loans and payroll protections. They used it to the point that they shut down the whole government system. And so I think we all know that actually sometimes the power of being small and scrappy and just knowing where to apply these automation tools is actually powerful enough to bring down the government.
Well, I've got one more question, and it's actually sort of two parts, because you've mentioned a number of applications, whether cloud-based or perhaps on-premises-based, that you could either take information from or put it into. What sort of number of different connectors do you have? And is that a static number? Is it growing? What's going on there? And the second piece is, you've also mentioned you doing some simple automation. and is building the processes, building the automation, something that you typically see happening within your customers themselves, or is this something where you would typically need to work with some sort of system integrator in order to have them put the automation together?
Great, great questions. And I think it does come down to the scale of the solution that you're building. So when we look at connectors, in many cases, anything that is on the web, RPA is going to work out of the box, right? In our case, there are a number of solutions. So for example, we have to do some interesting kind of gateway custom extensions for something like a older legacy system, like a SAP or an Oracle or something like that. So in one way, anything that's a SaaS, we can get you to immediately. And certainly we're continuing to grow out those connectors that are more of the on legacy or customized opportunities. And we're just really looking at the market to tell us how much further we go there versus are we all kind of moving a little bit more quickly to cloud and those SaaS providers where the sky's the limit as soon as you have the product. So I think we're still watching where the market is going on that. And to your second question around the people who use this, my philosophy around everything in intelligent process automation is that it needs to be powerful enough for your IT teams. So if you want to inject code somewhere, if you need to have much more of a systems integrator background, we want to provide all the tools that are really powerful and robust so that you can do everything that you have in mind to do for this solution. But it needs to be empowering for teams. And I think that citizen developer is coming maybe kind of an outdated term, but I really like it because the truth is when I have a large scale company-wide or in some cases customer-facing solution that I need to build, I'm going to talk to my IT team. But if I need to set up automation to build our roadmaps every month or remind my team about who's in charge of scheduling our enablement sessions, I need to be able to do that. And it's not a good use of IT's time or a developer's time to have to do that. So I think the actual future of all of this, whether it's intelligent process automation or the subset of RPA, is that it has to serve both. And if you are buying a product at the enterprise level that requires a system integrator for every solution, I think you probably want to reconsider that because it's just we've really moved beyond that level. I would say even in the last 5 years, the low-code, no-code space has just become so empowering for people who just didn't have access or a seat at that table before.
Now, we've heard some interesting news here. Now, we've heard of K2. They're a low-code, cloud-based digital process automation, DPA. Now, they tout the whole idea of automated workflows and automating your business processes. How does this play in, to what Nintex is doing? And what was the driving force behind the acquisition?
Yeah, I mean, to your point, we've been playing in the same space for quite a few years. And when I first joined Nintex about 6 years ago and we talked about the compete space, that was where K2 was. And so, you know, Nintex has been working to kind of find that niche story because our stories were very similar at the beginning. And now what we're looking at is in that space, we believe that rather than big single offering technology vendors where it's just RPA or just workflow or just forms or just anything is actually probably not what most businesses need, right? They need more of that breadth where you do have RPA in addition to your workflow automation. You do have document generation and e-signature and OCR and all the bazillion other tools that come into play here. And so as we were doing that and we were watching the market, we are also seeing that as part of our strategy to really empower those more technical teams, we wanted to not only consolidate the offerings that were in the market, of course, but to take some of the incredible technology and some of the, intellectual property that K2 has developed over the years with things like smart objects and smartphones that actually do have deeper capabilities on the developer front. And when we've started the effort, right? But we've only, I think we closed the acquisition about a month ago. when we come out of this kind of planning month, you know, couple months that we're in right now, being able to set a whole new vision for where we're going to go with this, knowing that now we've bolstered with a lot of incredible tech and a lot of high usability, paying a lot of attention to that citizen developer role and wearing that ease of use hat bigger than ever, right? And when you take really complicated or sophisticated systems, or you try to take things that have been development centric and make them more usable for more people, I mean, it's super fun and it's super hard. And that's where we're at right now. And so we are so excited to be working together and figuring out the future of where we can go, because it's just, again, it's more power, more tools, and making sure that those solutions are easier to come by whomever is needing to do the work.
Right. Sounds like there's a lot of solid solutions, a lot of capabilities already. We've talked a lot about what RPA brings to the table. Now, if I was an organization and I, you know, I wanted to get started, I wanted to set up a flow of information, or even, like you said, program a set of an automated process that allowed me to do some analytics, how do I get started? What do I do?
So I think a lot of this, and again, this is why I'm so passionate about getting more of the business involved and having more folks at the table in the beginning than just the IT teams and the technologists, because the truth is, the only thing worse than not automating is automating something that isn't optimized. And so you might get some benefits by just the amount of scale, but you're actually also magnifying any inefficiencies that are already baked in. And so when we talked about the orchestra metaphor in the previous segment, and my belief is with any project, and it doesn't matter if it is a huge digital transformation project for your business or it is a smaller, how do I automate our non-disclosure agreement generations for all of the people that our sales team talk to. You start with identifying the problems that you have and you pick one, right? You pick one, you talk to the stakeholders and you understand what's working, what's not working, what they need to do, what they wish they could do. And then you document the process. And whether you use Visio or Lucidcharts or 100 million other things, we at Nintex use ProMap. And there's a whole bunch of reasons for that. But basically, having a single source of truth, making sure that people can give you feedback on those processes, and that you can give your technical teams who are maybe building those larger solutions very clear requirements about how things work today, how they need to work, what systems are involved, and what's really important in terms of outcomes. And only then should you be considering what tools to be using, right? So to my point, if you're coming to the table saying, hey, it's time to do an RPA project, you might be setting yourself up for some higher risk there versus you pick a problem, you talk to the people who are involved, you document what an optimized process looks like, and then you go into your toolbox and you say, all right, I'm going to use intelligent process automation, which is going to include workflow and RPA and document generation and any number of other, whether it's artificial intelligence or cognitive services, there's a million places you could go. But that is actually the fastest way to value. And then coming out the other end of that, you celebrate what was hopefully a success, and then you just rinse and repeat and start again. And so it shouldn't be unattainable or feel like this really heavy lifting sort of planning process, because really the business and the technical teams together understanding the issues and the requirements, just like how all of us do feature development where we work, that is actually the key. And it sounds so simple, but it's just true. And that's where we get the biggest value in the market. And what our customers tell us is that exact thing, which is you actually think about the problem and you document it with something like a Nintex ProMap before you even consider what automation tools are going to be right for you.
Right. Well, great advice. Well, Zoe, thank you so much for being here. We're running a little low on time, but I did want to give you a chance to tell the folks at home a little bit more about Nintex and where folks can go to learn more about it.
Yeah, there is obviously head on over to Nintex.com, which is our corporate website. Check us out on Twitter as well, social media. But the thinking really is here is come watch some videos, get some demos, try some things out and see what makes sense to you. Because again, my big philosophy and the philosophy that we're working with at Nintex is that software works for us. Technology works for us as humans. And frankly, if something isn't easy and highly usable and quick to learn, you shouldn't be considering it because humans have better things to do. And the point of automation is to free up those big brains to allow them to do all the amazing things that humans are capable of and lead the rest to automation. And so, yeah, I could talk about it all day, but thanks for giving me a time to plug the big business. It's great.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Well, folks, you've done it again. You've sat through another hour of the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. So tune your podcatcher to Twyatt. But before I want to close the show up, I do want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to my co-host, starting with our very own Mr. Brian Chiebert. What's going on for you in the coming weeks, and where can people find you?
I'm listening to Twitter. I'm ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab. I'm also Chiebert at twit.tv, and I'd love to hear from you. But you know what? Why don't you use Twyatt at twit.tv? Because that'll hit all the hosts. And, you know, when I'm traveling across the country, I might miss a few. But anyway, just as a quick reminder, next week, the Twyatt is not on the air. We are all celebrating Thanksgiving, socially distanced, obviously. So just a reminder, no Twyatt next week. But we'll see you on December 4th as our next show.
Thank you, Chiebert. Well, we also have to thank our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, what's going on for you in the coming week, and where can people find you online?
Well, the coming week, I'm mainly going to be off, but I tell you what, I'm still keeping an eye on the Black Hat Europe speaker lineup. I did several interviews for that, got some articles coming out. Lots of interesting stuff going on. Talk to a number of fascinating people who are building tools for red team members. In other words, building the tools that allow the pen testers and other red teamers to really test network security. The interesting thing is that these same tools can be used in less scrupulous hands to genuinely attack the network. So lots of fascinating conversations there, looking at lots of great technology and how it can be used or misused.
Thanks, Curtis. Looking forward to that. Well, we also thank you as well. You're the people who drop in each and every week to watch and listen to our show and get your enterprise and IT goodness. We want to make it easy for you. We want to make it easy for you to watch and listen to our show and catch your enterprise news. So go to our show page right now, twit.tv/Twyatt. There you'll find all the amazing back episodes, the show notes, the co-hosts, the guest information, and, of course, the links of the stories we do during the show. But more importantly, next to those videos there, we'll get those helpful subscribe and download links. Support the show by getting your audio version, your video version of your choice, and listen in on any one of your devices and any one of your podcatcher applications. Subscribe. It's really the best way to stay on top of your enterprise and IT news. Plus, it's the best way to support our show. Now, after you subscribe, you can impress your friends, your family members, your coworkers as the holidays are coming. Share the gift of Twyatt because we talk about a bunch of fun tech topics on this show, and I can guarantee they will find them interesting as well. Now, if you've already subscribed, you can also watch the show live. We're here every Friday, 1:30 p.m. Pacific time on Fridays, except next Friday. And you can check that show at live.twit.tv. You can see the show live. You can come see the behind the scenes, how the pizza's made, all the fun stuff that we do here, all the banter we have here at Twit. And of course, if you're going to watch the show live, you might as well jump into our chat room as well at irc.twit.tv. There you have some amazing characters in there. We bring some great content, some great questions during the show. We have some great discussions. So definitely jump in there and be part of the family there as well. But you know what? If you're not available to be part of the live stream, live chat room, you're subscribed and you still want to be part of the conversation, that's okay. We have a 24/7 conversation place. You go right now to twit.community. There you have all the hosts are out there, the community's out there, show content, hosts, guests, discussions about some technologies out there. It's 24/7. So check it out, twit.community. You can be part of the conversation at any point in time. Remember, you can always follow me, twitter.com/LouMM. There I post all my enterprise tidbits. Of course, I post and have great conversations with people like you. And of course, I also post a little bit about my day job at Microsoft there, a little bit ways about how you can customize your office experience and make it more productive for you and your organization. You know what? I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to Leo and Lisa. They continue to support This Week in Enterprise Tech each and every week, and we couldn't do the show without them. So thank you so much for their support. I want to thank everyone at Twit, especially and all the engineers. I also want to thank Mr. Brian Chee one more time, just one more time, because not only is he our co-host, but he's also our tireless producer, and he does all the bookings and the plannings for the show, and we just couldn't do the show without him. So thank you again, Cheeber, for all your support. And, of course, before we sign out, we have to thank our editor behind the scenes, Mr. Victor. He makes us look good. And, of course, Mr. Amp Pruitt. He's the TD for today. And tell us what's going on for you in the coming week here at Twit.
Hopefully it's going to be a little bit of rest with the holiday coming up. But other than that, we got to keep creating some awesome content over here.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We're looking forward to it. And until next time, I'm Louis Maresca. Just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the Enterprise, just keep Twit.
Want more Twit? Well, check out Smart Tech Today. It's at twit.tv/STT. It's the show where Matthew Casinelli and I cover everything there is to know about smart tech. It's automation, it's connected devices, it's smart home, it's all those goodies and so much more. We get the news, we get the latest devices, we do reviews, everything. You gotta check it out, twit.tv/STT for Smart Tech Today.